Chapter 8, Early 20th Century. As the new century began, Tennessee was troubled by conflicts between the values of its traditional agrarian culture and the demands of a modern, increasingly urban world. Having lost its position of national leadership during the Civil War, the state had become somewhat isolated from the changes taking place in metropolitan centers. Tremendous intellectual, scientific, and technological innovations were sweeping America early in the 20th century, and Tennessee became a major battleground where these forces clashed with older rural folkways. Issues such as prohibition, women's suffrage, religion, and education came to the forefront of political debate, replacing the economic issues that had dominated late 19th century politics. By 1900, temperance, the movement to limit the consumption of alcohol, had become a moral and political crusade to prohibit liquor altogether. Distilling whiskey and other spirits was an old and accomplished craft in Tennessee, one that had continued despite the efforts of federal agents and local sheriffs to stamp it out. In 1877, temperance advocates in the General Assembly had managed to pass a 4-mile law prohibiting the sale of alcohol within a 4-mile radius of a public school. 30 years later, the liquor issue dominated the gubernatorial race between Senator Edward Carmack, the dry candidate, and Malcolm Patterson, who opposed prohibition and eventually won by a slender margin. Through his newspaper, The Tennessean, the defeated Carmack waged a vicious war of words against Governor Patterson and his supporters. On November 9, 1908, the squabble culminated in a gun battle on the Nashville streets that left Carmack dead and two of the governor's closest advisors charged with murder. Carmack's killing gave the prohibition movement a martyr, in part because the man who shot him was pardoned by the governor and created the momentum to pass legislation extending the 4-mile law. The new law banned liquor over virtually the entire state. Prohibitionists gained control of the Republican Party, and their candidate Ben Hooper won election as governor in 1910 and 1912. Tennessee remained nominally dry from 1909 until the repeal of national prohibition in 1933, although the law met with considerable resistance from, among others, the mayors of Nashville and Memphis, whose political machines functioned to some extent through saloons. Statewide prohibition was never effectively enforced, yet the issue continues today in the form of local option ordinances against liquor. Tennessee became the focus of national attention during the campaign for women's voting rights. Women's suffrage, like temperance, was an issue with its roots in middle-class reform efforts of the late 1800s. The organized movement came of age with the founding of the Tennessee Equal Suffrage Association in 1906. Despite a determined and largely female opposition, Tennessee suffragists were moderate in their tactics and gained limited voting rights before the national question arose. In 1920, Governor Albert Roberts called a special session of the legislature to consider ratification of the 19th Amendment. Leaders of the rival groups flooded into Nashville to lobby the General Assembly. In a close House vote, the suffrage amendment won passage when an East Tennessee legislator, Harry Byrne, switched sides after receiving a telegram from his mother encouraging him to support ratification. Tennessee thereby became the pivotal state that put the 19th Amendment over the top. Women immediately made their presence felt by swinging Tennessee to Warren Harding in the 1920 presidential election, the first time the state had voted for a Republican presidential candidate since 1868. Further national attention, not necessarily praiseworthy, came Tennessee's way during the celebrated trial of John T. Scopes, the so-called Monkey Trial. In 1925, the legislature, as part of a general education bill, passed a law that forbade the teaching of evolution in public schools. Some local boosters in Dayton concocted a scheme to have Scopes, a high school biology teacher, violate the law and stand trial as a way of drawing publicity and visitors to the town. Their plan worked all too well, as the Ray County Courthouse was turned into a circus of national and even international media coverage. Thousands flocked to Dayton to witness the high-powered legal counsel, William Jennings Bryan for the prosecution, and Clarence Darrow for the defense, among others, argue their case. Tennessee was ridiculed in the Northern press as the Monkey State, even as a wave of revivals defending religious fundamentalism swept the state. The legal outcome of the trial was inconsequential. Scopes was convicted and fined $100, a penalty later rescinded by the State Court of Appeals. The law itself remained on the books until 1967. More important was the law's symbolic importance, an expression of anxiety felt by Tennessee's rural people over the threat to their traditional religious culture posed by modern science. This issue, too, is still being contested in Tennessee. Another clash between community practices and the forces of modernity took place in 1908 at Real Foot Lake in the northwest corner of the state. The lake, an exceptionally rich fishery and game habitat, had for many years supported local fishermen and hunters who supplied West Tennessee hotels and restaurants with fish, turtles, swans, and ducks. Outside businessmen and their lawyers began buying up the lake and shoreline in order to develop it as a private resort. In the process, they denied access to the lake to local citizens who had long made their livelihoods from it. Some of these people, having failed to stop the developers in court, resorted to the old custom of vigilante acts or night riding to stop them. Dressed in masks and cloaked in darkness, the night riders terrorized county officials, kidnapped two land company lawyers, and lynched one of them in the autumn of 1908. Governor Patterson called out the state militia to quell the violence. Eight night riders were brought to trial, but all eventually went free. Fearing further outbreaks of violence over the private development of the lake, the state began to acquire the lake property as a public resource. In 1925, Real Foot Lake was established as a state game and fish preserve, making a first step toward the conservation of Tennessee's natural resources. Ironically, at the very time that Tennessee's rural culture was under attack by city critics, its music found a national audience. In 1925, WSM, a powerful Nashville radio station, began broadcasting a weekly program of live music that was soon dubbed the Grand Ole Opry. The music came in diverse forms: banjo and fiddle string bands of Appalachia, family gospel singing groups, and country vaudeville acts like that of Murfreesboro native Uncle Dave Macon. One of the most popular stars of the early Opry was a black performer, Dee Ford Bailey. Still the longest-running radio program in American history, the Opry used the new technology of radio to tap into a huge market of old-time or hillbilly music. 2 years after the Opry's opening, in a series of landmark sessions at Bristol, Tennessee, field scouts of the Victor Company recorded Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family to produce the first nationally popular rural records. Tennessee thus emerged as the heartland of traditional country music, home to many of the performers as well as the place from which it was broadcast to the nation. Just as Tennessee was fertile ground for the music enjoyed by white audiences, so was it a center for the blues music popular with African Americans. Both had their roots in the dances, harvest festivals, work songs, and camp meetings of rural communities. Memphis, strategically located at the top of the Mississippi River Delta where the blues sound originated, was already a center for this music by the 1920s. The city became a magnet that drew performers from cotton farms to the clubs of Beale Street, the Upper South's premier black main street. Lacking the radio exposure that benefited white country music, Beale Street nonetheless offered a rich musical setting where one could hear everything from W.C. Handy's dance band to the jazz-accompanied blues of Ma Rainey or Chattanooga-born Bessie Smith. Delta blues spread across the country as better highways and the lure of wartime jobs brought greater numbers of rural blacks into the cities. Though far removed from the European fields of World War I, Tennesseans contributed their usual full complement to America's war effort. Around 100,000 of the state's young men volunteered or were drafted into the armed services, and a large proportion of those actually served with the American Expeditionary Force in Europe. More than 17,000 of the 61,000 Tennessee conscripts were African Americans. although black units were still segregated and commanded by white officers. 4,000 Tennesseans were killed in combat or perished in the influenza epidemic that swept through the crowded troop camps at War's End. Tennessee provided the most celebrated American soldier of the First World War, Alvin C. York of Fentress County, a former conscientious objector who, in October of 1918, subdued an entire German machine gun regiment in the Argonne Forest. Besides receiving the Congressional Medal of Honor and assorted French decorations, York became a powerful symbol of patriotism in the press and Hollywood film. State politics and government were transformed following World War I. Austin P. of Clarksville served as the first three-term governor since William Carroll, due in large part to the backing of rural and small-town voters. Governor P. streamlined government agencies and reduced the state property tax while imposing an excise tax on corporate profits. When his administration began, the state had only 250 miles of paved roads, but P. undertook a massive road-building program with the revenue generated by Tennessee's first gasoline tax. He crisscrossed the state with thousands of miles of hard-surface highways, making him very popular among voters in once-remote rural areas. Another achievement of the P. administration was the part it played in overhauling public education. At the beginning of the century, Tennessee had no state-supported high schools, and fewer than half of its eligible children attended school. Teacher salaries were abysmal, and there was only one public university, which received no state funding. In 1909, the legislature allotted 25% of state revenues to education, and in 1913, that share was increased to one-third. A compulsory school attendance law was passed. County high schools were established, normal schools for teachers were built, including Tennessee Agricultural and Industrial Normal School, a segregated black college, and the University of Tennessee finally received state support. Building on this base, Governor P.'s 1925 education law gave funding for an 8-month school term and inaugurated the modern system of school administration. The 1925 Act also supplemented teacher salaries, standardized teacher certification, and turned the normal schools into 4-year teacher colleges. Although some of these reforms did not survive the 30s, Tennessee nevertheless had dramatically improved its public school system. The stock market crash of October 1929 is usually considered the start of that decade of hardship known as the Great Depression. In Tennessee, the hard times had started earlier, particularly for farmers. World War I had raised agricultural prices and brought flush times, but with the coming of peace, the export markets dried up and prices plummeted. The longest and most devastating drought on record added to stagnant farm markets. Low returns on farming drove many of the poorest class of farmers completely off the land, as the old system of tenancy, landlord stores, and scrip money began to collapse. Tractors and mechanical cotton pickers were also reducing the number of hands needed to farm, and the 1920s witnessed a sustained exodus of black and white sharecroppers to the cities. The black population of Tennessee actually declined during this period because of the heavy migration to northern industrial centers like Chicago. Some of these displaced country people found jobs at Tennessee factories such as the DuPont plant in Old Hickory, the rayon plants in Elizabethan, Eastman Kodak in Kingsport, and the Aluminum Company of America Works plant in Blount County. These large enterprises had replaced the earlier rough manufacturing, textiles, timber, flour, and mill products as the state's leading industries. The Alcoa plant was built specifically to take advantage of East Tennessee's fast-falling rivers in order to generate electricity. Private hydroelectric dams were constructed in the state as early as 1910, and the prospect of harnessing rivers to produce power would eventually prove a strong attraction for industry. Tennessee was still a predominantly agricultural state, but it now had a growing industrial workforce and, in East Tennessee, the beginnings of an organized labor movement. Strikes, while less common than in northern states, were becoming more prevalent. This emerging industrial economy, however, was soon hobbled by the shutdowns and high unemployment of the 30s. The Depression made everyone's lot worse. Farmers produced more and made less in return. Young people left the farms only to be laid off in the cities. Merchants could not sell their goods. Doctors had patients who could not pay. And teachers were paid in heavily discounted scrip instead of U.S. currency. In the countryside, people dug ginseng or sold walnuts to make a little extra income while city dwellers lined up for relief or went back to the farms where at least they could survive. Local governments were unable to collect taxes and hundreds of businesses failed, 578 in 1932 alone. In 1930, the failure of three major banking institutions, including one of the South's premier firms, Caldwell & Company, brought most of financial business in the state to a grinding halt. The demise of the financial empire of Nashvillian Rogers Caldwell not only liquidated the savings of thousands of depositors and $7 million in state funds, it nearly caused the impeachment of newly elected Governor Henry Horton. Governor Horton had close ties with Caldwell and his political ally Luke Lee, a newspaper publisher who was ultimately convicted of fraud and sent to prison. Leading the outcry for the governor's impeachment was former Memphis Mayor Edward H. Crump, who quickly assumed the role as boss of state politics and Shelby County. Between 1932 and 1948, anyone who wished to be governor or senator had to have Crump's blessing, although some of his protégés defied the boss once they were in office. A $2 poll tax kept voter turnout low during these years, and heavy majorities from Shelby County, which the Crump organization routinely achieved by paying the tax for compliant voters, could easily swing a statewide Democratic primary. In 1936, for example, Gordon Browning won election as governor with the help of 60,218 votes from Shelby County to only 861 for his opponent. Crump was the most powerful politician in Tennessee during most of the 30s and 40s, by virtue of being able to deliver a vast block of votes to whichever candidate he chose. Part of the success of urban political machines, like Crump's and that of Nashville Mayor Hillary House, was due to the support they received from black political organizations. Robert Church Jr. was the political leader of the Memphis black community, major Republican power broker, and dispenser of hundreds of federal patronage jobs. In Nashville, James C. Napier held much the same position as a political spokesman for middle-class African Americans. While these leaders followed a moderate course, avoiding confrontation and accepting the half-loaf offered by white politicians like Crump, other African Americans were willing to attack Jim Crow laws more directly. In 1905, R.H. Boyd and other Nashville entrepreneurs followed a successful boycott of segregated streetcars by organizing a competing black-owned streetcar company. 20 years later in Chattanooga, black working men organized to defeat a resurgent Ku Klux Klan at the polls and responded to black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey's visit to the city by forming a local chapter of his Universal Negro Improvement Association. By taking industrial jobs at higher wages, serving in the military, or simply by leaving the landlord's farm, black Tennesseans achieved a degree of independence that made them less willing to tolerate second-class citizenship. Tennessee, which had been out of the political spotlight since Reconstruction, returned to national prominence in the 1920s. Joseph W. Burns of Robertson County was Speaker of the United States House of Representatives during the crucial early years of the New Deal. Senator Kenneth D. McKellar of Memphis, who worked closely with the Crump organization, served six consecutive terms from 1916 to 1952. As chairman of the powerful Senate Appropriations Committee, he steered a considerable amount of military spending and industry Tennessee's way during World War II. Cordell Hull of Salina, who was in Congress continuously from 1907 to 1933, except for 2 years as Democratic National Chairman, authored the 1913 Federal Income Tax Bill and guided American foreign policy for 12 years as Secretary of State. Tennesseans, like most Americans, gave a resounding majority to Franklin D. Roosevelt in the 1932 presidential election. And over the next 12 years, his New Deal programs would have as great an impact in Tennessee as anywhere in the nation. 100,000 farmers statewide participated in the crop production program of the Agricultural Adjustment Act, AAA, while 55,250 young men enlisted in one of the 35 Civilian Conservation Corps, CCC, camps in the state. The road building projects and public works of the Public Works Administration, PWA, and Works Progress Administration, WPA, put thousands of unemployed Tennesseans to work. New Deal agencies spent large sums of tax dollars in Tennessee, $350 million in 1933 to 1935 alone, in an effort to stimulate the region's economy through public employment and investment. By far, the greatest expenditure of federal dollars in Tennessee was made through the Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA. In one way or another, TVA had an impact on the lives of nearly all Tennesseans. The agency was created in 1933, largely through the persistence of U.S. Senator George Norris of Nebraska, and headquartered in Knoxville. It was charged with the task of planning the total development of the Tennessee River Valley. TVA sought to do this primarily by building hydroelectric dams, 20 between 1933 and 1951, and several coal-fired power plants to produce electricity. Inexpensive and abundant electrical power was the main benefit that TVA brought to Tennessee, particularly to rural areas that previously did not have electrical service. TVA electrified some 60,000 farm households across the state. By 1945, TVA was the largest electrical utility in the nation, a supplier of vast amounts of power whose presence in Tennessee attracted large industries to relocate near one of its dams or steam plants. One group of Tennessee-based intellectuals achieved national prominence by questioning the desirability of such industrialization for the South. The agrarians at Vanderbilt University celebrated the region's agricultural heritage and challenged the wisdom of moving rural people aside to make room for modern development. Donald Davidson, in particular, objected to massive government land acquisitions that displaced communities and flooded some of the best farmland in the valley. TVA, for example, purchased or condemned 1.1 million acres of land, flooded 300,000 acres, and moved the homes of 14,000 families in order to build its first 16 dams. On a slightly smaller scale, 420,000 acres of forested mountainous land along the crest of the Appalachian Range was set aside during the 1930s for a national park. Although much of this land belonged to timber companies, creation of the hugely popular Great Smoky Mountains National Park displaced some 4,000 mountain people, including long-standing communities like Cades Cove. The price of progress was often highest for those citizens most directly affected by such projects. Despite the millions of dollars that TVA and the federal government pumped into Tennessee, the Depression ended with only the economic stimulus that came from going to war. World War II brought relief mainly by employing 10% of the state's populace, 308,199 men and women in the armed services. Most of those who remained on farms and in cities worked in war-related production, as Tennessee received war orders amounting to $1.25 billion. From the giant shell-loading plants in Milan to the Volte Aircraft Works in Nashville and the TVA projects in East Tennessee, war-based industries hummed with the labor of a greatly enlarged workforce. Approximately 33% of the state's workers were female by the end of the war. Tennessee military personnel served with distinction from Pearl Harbor to the final bloody assaults of Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and 7,000 died in combat during the war. In 1942 to 1943, Middle Tennessee residents played host to 28 Army divisions that swarmed over the countryside on maneuvers preparing for the D-Day invasion. Tennesseans participated in all phases of the war, from combat to civilian administration and military research. Cordell Hull served 12 years as President Roosevelt's Secretary of State and became one of the chief architects of the United Nations, for which he received the Nobel Peace Prize. Even ordinary citizens experienced the war's deprivation through the rationing of food and gasoline and the planting of victory gardens. Especially significant for the war effort was Tennessee's role in the Manhattan Project, the military's top secret project to build an atomic weapon. Research and production work for the first A-bombs were conducted at the huge scientific industrial installation at Oak Ridge in Anderson County. The Oak Ridge community was entirely a creation of the war. It mushroomed from empty woods in 1941 to Tennessee's fifth largest city, with a population of 70,000 4 years later. Twice in 1945, city streets and courthouse squares erupted with celebrations as the news of victory in Europe and the Pacific reached the state. For Tennessee, World War II constituted a radical break with the past. TVA had transformed the physical landscape of the state, and wartime industrialism had irreversibly changed the economy. Soldiers who had been overseas and women who had worked in factories returned home with new expectations for the future.